This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello, salam alaikum, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defense on FNX. I'm your host Stel, and I have two co-hosts with me tonight. First of all, it's Mr. Yanakis J with his shaved head. How you doing?
Yeah, not bad, mate. You alright?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Every week you're trying to be more and more like me, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm not getting anywhere, but after losing yesterday, I thought I was depressed, but I thought I'd get the head shaved off. But to be fair, I did it before the game, so there's no excuses there.
Well, you got the head shaved, you support the same club, you've also got depression and anxiety. So, yeah, we're kind of like two peas in a pod, but you're like mini me. Yeah,
absolutely. But the thing is, what made it worse is the barber got it wrong.
What, you asked for a number two and he gave you a number one?
Yeah, I told him to cut my hair short and he goes, are you ready? I said, yeah. And then all I see is the clippers in the middle of my head. So I'm too late, I had to shave it off.
Okay, can we just rewind for a second? What did he say?
He said, are you ready?
Right, for all of our listeners, can you tweet us at Shoot the Defense and let us know which nationality Jan's barber is? Because I need to know this. Is he Turkish? Is he Greek? Is he Albanian? Is he... I don't know what he is. Are you ready?
I'll leave it to the end of the show and I'll reveal the ethnicity.
Ooh, are you going to give us a clue?
No.
Come on, which former team did he play for? Which former players did he play alongside?
I don't think anyone's going to get it, to be honest.
Was his former teammate Florin Radicioiu?
No, he wasn't Romanian, no.
Oh, okay. Are you ready? Speaking of which, Dan De Luca, are you ready?
I'm not ready yet, no. I might shave my head next time Tottenham win instead of lose. I think I'll be safe for a little, to be honest. Is it Amir Zaki? Is that who cut your hair?
Oh, that's not a bad shout.
Is it Youssef Chippo?
Yeah. What a player. I don't want to ruin the quiz. No, I'm good, thank you. Oh, good, good to be back on.
Well, I was about to say, you know, that if the next time Spurs lose a game or make it three defeats on the trot, that's when you should shave your head.
Yeah, I was just saying I quite like my hair, so it's probably better that I shave it next time we win and I might be able to keep it for a bit longer.
Have you ever had a dodgy haircut?
I liked it down until yesterday.
Huh?
I said I liked my hair until yesterday.
Oh, okay. Well, we've already spoken about you. I'm talking about Dan now. You've had your 5 minutes in the sun. Come on now.
All
right. Dan, have you ever had any dodgy haircuts?
Yeah, I had a two all over when I was 17 on holiday with the boys, and it was a school sports tour, so it was out. We had the coach out, and I had a bet with a coach about a particular girl, and I won, and he had to shave his head, and he got his revenge by the end of the holiday. I looked fucking terrible.
Oh, but question is, was she shaved?
Was she shaved? She was not. No, well, I don't know about his one. I didn't get to see that. But I'll put a picture if I can find one of my terrible hair face. You can't have short hair when you're me. I've got a really big nose, so I just look like a little Daniel Levy. It's not.
Oh man, that's really not helping.
No good. Never again.
Well, I don't blame you. I've had my fair share of dodgy hairstyles, dodgy hair colours, all that kind of stuff. I experimented quite a bit when I was younger, and not just with hair, but let's not go into that, as Jan knows. Right.
Yeah, I nearly shit myself with your tattoo, didn't I?
Yeah, see, that I tell people that story and they don't believe me. Should I refresh your memory, Jan, and tell the story, or would you like to... We were in Manchester and we went to the Arndale Centre, and I got the buzz because I wanted to get a tattoo, and there was a Selfridges on the first or second floor, I can't remember, and they had a sign outside that said that they actually were doing tattoos. So I said to Jan, let me go get one, and you're like, what? I was like, yeah, fuck it, why not, and we sat there for well, it was about 20 minutes before the girl saw us, and she was quite cute as well, weren't she, Ian?
Yeah, Asian girl, weren't she?
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I just got MUFC tattooed on my arm, and Jan almost fainted. Was it the sound, or was it just the needle itself that did it?
Yeah, I think it was the needle. I remember just having the shakes, and I started sweating. I was going to pass out, wouldn't you? So that put me off tattoos. That's why I've never had one in my life.
Well, it's weird, because it's like when you see these sketches on TV with a woman, you know, giving birth, and the husband passes out. That's kind of how it felt.
Okay. I think we should start the show now.
10 minutes in.
I need to know what else makes Jan want to pass out, and just in case I'm out and about with him, so I don't have to go through that situation and calling an ambulance or something.
Probably Lukaku's finishing.
Okay, well, we'll get back onto that later. Okay, let's kick off our review show in the Championship, actually, where Jack Grealish stole the headlines with something you'd expect to see from a low-budget independent film about a footballer who was attacked by a fan in a big derby game and recovered to score the winner. The said fan, and I use that term loosely, has been jailed for 14 weeks, been ordered to pay £350 in fines and costs, and banned from attending any games in the UK for 10 years. But that still doesn't mean he can't go to, I don't know, Bucharest and become an ultra. I don't bloody know. Gents, that's pretty much what happened in the second City derby. A three-part question to you all. What did you make of the incident? Who is to blame for it? What measures should clubs and authorities take to prevent this from happening again? Dan, you start first, mate.
I can't blame anyone other than the fan and his friends who he sits with and the people who cheered afterwards. And there's a bit of social media in there as well, probably, because the way fans behave off the pitch at the moment is poor. And that's making its way back to the terraces. You just look as a steward, what can you do? You know, there's, I don't know, 25,000, 35,000 people at this game. How would you keep them all off the pitch? You know, people have been getting on sports things for years. You know, you can't stop them. They're going to get first run on you when they're on the pitch. And then there's a fat steward chasing after him, and he's not going to catch him. So I can't really blame the club. I don't see what they can do, really. We've had the days of fences to keep fans off, and you know that has its other risks that obviously we don't want to see ever again. So I can't really blame Birmingham City as a football club.
But Dan, you've been to enough games to know that a lot of the stewards are A, underpaid, B, don't really care about... Actually, no, that's a bit unfair. I'd say they're not as vigilant as what they should be. Because if you watch games on the telly, you see a lot of stewards actually watching the game, not the fans. Yep. So it wouldn't surprise me if a couple of them took their eye off the ball, so to speak, no pun intended, and allowed him to get on.
Yeah, I guess I guess the answer to this particular issue is, if I was a steward, what would I do? I'd watch the game. So... I mean, it's understandable that most stewards, when you become a steward, I can't imagine you do it because you want to run on a field and rescue a player from a hooligan, I guess.
Or cats, you know, or foxes, or pigeons, or
dogs. Yeah, chasing after a dog or whatever. But, you know, you're there, you're showing people to their seats, you're making sure everyone's safe, you know the fire evacuation policy if you need to get out quickly, that sort of stuff. But in actual fact, let's look at this game. It's Birmingham against Aston Villa. It's always pretty nasty. I've been to one, the second City derby. I went just to soak up the atmosphere. It was in a League Cup. And then I went to Spurs Arsenal the next day. And my missus was fuming. But I went just to soak up the atmosphere. And it's nasty. They're smashing pubs up in the street before the game. So you've got to look as a club, what can they do is the question you asked me. For games of this profile, why can't you get in, you know, a different level of security for these games, like hiring a security firm. Easier in the Premier League, probably, where the clubs can afford it. But that's probably the only answer, really. If a person decides to run on the pitch, by the time you realise what he's doing, he's gone. And that's the reality.
Yeah?
Did the police intervene after the incident? Because I think I saw the stewards run on the pitch, but did the police come onto the pitch?
Yeah, so the steward sort of rugby tackled him in the end. They sort of gathered him round and there was a big crowd. And then they started walking him off and then the police took him away from that point.
Yeah, but the police didn't come onto the pitch. When
No. It was a steward on the pitch to make the interception.
Right, okay.
And I don't know if you see after Grealish scored, But yeah, there was a steward that was arrested later on. Yeah. And then he was let go pretty quickly after. And the police were closer to that incident.
What I'm saying is, why didn't the police run onto the pitch when that happened?
Probably weren't enough of him.
Sorry, mate?
Probably weren't enough of him.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Dan. In a game of that magnitude, when there's so much hate and so much animosity and tension in the stadium, surely there's got to be more police officers around the stadium. I didn't see a lot yesterday. As for the incident, how do you stop it? I mean, the thing is, what can stewards do still? You know, if I decide, you know, if me and you decide we're going on the pitch because we want to thump Lukaku and we just run onto the pitch, what's he going to do? How's he going to stop us? Or how is she going to stop us?
Well, look, at the end of the day, right, stewards, their job is to do exactly what Dan said. Show these people to their seat and just kind of diffuse situations if need be. You know, you and I, you know, all of us, we've all been to games where emotions run high and fans get a bit too excited. And, you know, I remember a mate of ours, Theo, he celebrated the goal for United against Middlesbrough. And he got sent into it wasn't really a prison, but it was like a little cell because he was over-celebrating and they thought that he was going to climb into the Middlesbrough. When he wasn't, he was tiny. He was only like 18, 19 at the time. And he almost fell over the separating barrier that separated the fans from each other, so to speak. So their job isn't to really be like enforcers, so to speak, like law enforcement officers, you know. And I think that's where the problem lies. They don't have the power to do what the police do or whatever. But at the same time, you know, you can't just keep giving power to people, you know, for these kind of events. I think the main concern is, you know, this fan ran on the pitch and he hit the player. What if he had the knife?
Yeah.
What if he had a knife or something on him? You just don't know. Remember what happened with Monica Seles in 93? She got stabbed,
but
didn't she?
It happened at the Emirates yesterday with Smalling.
Yeah, fan ran on the pitch and pushed him. But I'm not saying that was okay, but it was much more toned down. I don't know if you remember, Dida got slapped or pushed over by a Celtic fan in 2004.
Yeah, there was the AZ goalkeeper who got attacked by the fan then he kicked him back. You know.
Well, there was a Turkish fan that ran on the pitch when United played Galatasaray in 92, 93, wasn't there? And Schmeichel wrestled him to the ground.
That's right.
It happened at West Ham not long ago. A couple of fans were on the pitch. You had Mark Noble fighting with one, didn't you? And in the Champions League final against Liverpool, Real Madrid, Liverpool, someone came on and tackled Ronaldo.
That's right.
Which was great. It was great because I had a bet on 3-1 and he was 4 on goal to make it 4. So I was delighted. And if I was there, I might have made a tackle as well. But the point is, the question for me is, why does the fan want to do that? 10 minutes into the game, by the way, he's not even watched the game. His team aren't even losing yet. Why is he that angry after 10 minutes? That's the bit that I can't get my head around.
Dan, it was premeditated, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a personal.
He was always gonna. Well, he was always gonna try and do that, whether it be in the 10th minute or the 90th minute, you know. And this is a concern because I know you mentioned social media earlier, and that plays a huge part as far as I'm concerned because there's obviously people tweeting each other or messaging each other before and after games, and then you have everyone, you know, fans have got video footage of things that have happened within the ground, and then people retweet and it's like, oh, that person is such a lad, he's such a geezer, da 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 da. And a lot of it is for attention. A lot of it's for attention. And the guy's 27 years old, he's not a kid, he's a grown ass man.
Now, listen, guys, the worst thing for me, I don't know if you lot saw it, didn't he not post a tweet about Grealish's brother dying?
It was another person.
After the game.
Sorry?
Another fan, I think, after the game.
I thought it was him.
No, it was someone else. And again, it's that kind of stupidness, you know. It's that kind of stupidness that adds fuel to the fire, you know. And see, this is the thing, and I'm going to go back to something that is completely off topic here. I mean, my previous Twitter account was suspended because I had an argument with someone with 28,000 followers. But then you got people like him and people that put, you know, photographs of kids naked and that kind of stuff, and they're all right to continue because the Twitter police don't do anything about it. But if you upset someone with a blue tick or a certain amount of 1,000 followers, then you're going to get suspended, which is ridiculous.
I think the thing with Twitter is dangerous for a lot of reasons, like the rivalries, the Spurs Arsenal rivalry. Over the last 5 years, has turned into like worse than ever before. The hatred is just, it's on a different level. And part of that is because now Spurs actually aren't a terrible team. So there's something worth arguing about. And actually, the problem with Twitter, it's not like Facebook or other forms. I know we all benefit from Twitter and we enjoy it, and a lot of people make their businesses on it and whatever. But the thing with Twitter is you're kind of anonymous. It's not like Facebook. I can look on Facebook in a minute. I can work out where you live, who you are, what your cat's name is, and who your girlfriend is. Twitter, no one knows who the fuck you are. You can say what you want. You can get banned. You can open another account. It goes on and on and on and on and on.
Dad, I feel the hatred as much as has like improved over the five years. I just think because of social media and the influence it has, you know, we're very quick to go, I hate Liverpool. I can't stand them. I hope this happens. It's very easy to tweet these kind of things. So the more people that do it, the more you think, oh my God, you know, these lot really hate Liverpool. I just think because of social media, it's easy for us fans to express our feelings a lot on there because everybody sees it.
Yeah, you are right. And it's the anonymity of it that allows idiots. And actually, do you know what? If you make a point, cause it influences me. Because sometimes I'm having arguments with strangers and I'm being quite rude. And I'm thinking if I was talking to him, I'd probably just explain it in a nice, normal way. But because it's on Twitter, I'm calling him an idiot. And I don't know what it is about Twitter, but it makes you nasty. Yeah. it makes you do things you wouldn't normally do as a human being, I guess.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? I think it's because you've got the phone at your hand, and you know, we all say things in the heat of the moment. It always happens. You know, we might say it to our loved ones, we might say it in the working environment, whatever. But with Twitter, because as you said, you're behind a screen, your thumbs are just like ready to pounce, whether it be to retweet someone or to quote tweet someone, or as you said, just to go off on one about someone, which is why I said to you before the show, when United are playing, I stop tweeting. Because I read the timeline and you got all these so-called experts coming out with utter garbage. And if you spend all your time getting wound up with what they're tweeting out, you're not enjoying the game, whether your team's winning or losing. You know, you don't see the bigger picture. You always tend to read what other people are tweeting and think, oh, they might be right, or I completely disagree with them, but I'm going to argue with them instead of just trying to be rational about it. It's very rare that it's happened to me. It's very rare that you put out a tweet during the game and someone agrees with you, but they're either going to agree with you wholeheartedly or they're going to completely try and tear you apart with because of your opinion, you know? Yeah. And they always throw in this, oh, because you're a podcaster, or this and that doesn't mean that you know better. No one's saying that because I'm a podcaster that I know better. I'm just saying that's just my opinion. But you get that. And I think when it came to this game, Villa and Birmingham, the hatred is there. It's been there for a while. In fact, I remember Peter Enkelman got pushed over by a fan at one point, didn't he?
Yeah, the guy came on and rubbed his hair, didn't he? He let in an absolute howler.
Yeah, under his studs. So, yeah, I just think that because of the way that social media is, everyone's got an opinion, everyone's got a platform, and all it takes is one tweet to, in inverted commas, bang, and all of a sudden people jump onto it and say, yeah, that must be gospel because this guy's got like 10,000 retweets. It's ridiculous.
Oh, you couldn't put it any better, mate. I
probably could have put it more eloquently, but I chose not to. Anyway. Right, speaking of social media, the game of the weekend was the social media derby between Arsenal and Man United. both teams went into the game on the back of contrasting results in midweek. United, fresh from a famous victory against Paris Saint-Germain, or ISIS-SG as I like to call them, hoped to pile more misery on Arsenal after Unai Emery's men failed to beat Rennes, losing 3-1. Unfortunately for Ole's men, Arsenal reacted the way you'd expect from a wounded animal and punished United for their poor finishing. Granit Xhaka opened the scoring with a 25-yard strike that De Gea really should have saved, and Aubameyang gained retribution for last week's penalty miss in the North London derby by scoring from the spot and sealing all 3 points for the Gunners. Now, Jan, the unbeaten run is over, although United only have themselves to blame, in my opinion. They allowed Arsenal to get in the front foot, and had it not been for Lukaku's missing the opening minutes, it probably would have been a different scoreline. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I agree with you again, Stel.
Stop it. Stop it.
Yeah, no, I don't like agreeing with you, to be fair, but you're kind of making some decent points for once. it was a strange game, Stel, to be honest with you, from start to finish. First 15, 20 minutes, Arsenal were the better side. I thought they came out of the blocks quite fiery, which you expect from a team who's just lost and they're at home and they're playing a team that they don't really like. But like you said, if Lukaku doesn't miss from 5 yards and hits the bar, then, you know, it's a totally different game. United go 1-0 up and then, you know, they can do what they've done to Arsenal for so many years and hit them on the counter-attack. But unfortunately, Xhaka's goal, which is a free goal, because 9 out of 10 times De Gea saves that. I don't know what the goalkeeper's doing, to be honest. And I don't understand his kind of logic behind where he's going. You know, Xhaka's 25, 30 yards, so I don't think that was kind of necessary for him to start moving as soon as he did. But hey, he did. And then, you know, to be fair, Arsenal didn't even create a lot for the whole game. I don't even recall that David De Gea making a save the whole game. So, and United missed, I don't know, 5, 6 glorious chances. So, and the penalty's not a penalty. You know, for me, it's a blatant dive by Lacazette. But because it's Lacazette and he's maybe a nice guy on the pitch and whatever, nothing's made out of it. I mean, you know, if you look at the incident, which all of us have done, even if there was minimal contact by Fred, Lacazette goes down in stages and probably 3-4 seconds after goes down. It's never a pen, but it's given. Aubameyang takes it and that was game over, really. United looked very lethargic the whole game. They look tired, to be honest.
Do you know what? I don't know, Jan, because the way I see it is that United didn't hit the ground running from the first whistle. They allowed Arsenal to play the game. Arsenal weren't particularly great going forward. I know that they had a few half chances, but nothing really to worry about. In fact, when United went a goal down, they kind of stepped up again. In the second half, they went for it. But what, as a United fan,
As we've known, United, you know, it's well known, United beat Arsenal on the counter-attack. They've done it for so many years. I think what Emery done on Sunday was they allowed United to have the ball. So they allowed United to have the ball so Arsenal can sit deep so that United couldn't hit them on the counter-attack. Basically, as the home team, you would have thought that Arsenal would take the initiative, attack United, and then maybe United pick them off on the break. But it didn't happen like that. It was more like the other way around, where they waited for United to attack and then Arsenal to counter-attack United. So Emery, in that sense, to be fair, got his tactics spot on, I thought, on Sunday. I thought he did. I thought that, you know, Arsenal going 3 at the back, so definitely helped them.
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, we were a goal down at half-time. We didn't look like scoring. I know Lukaku had that chance in the opening few minutes. But I just think that Solskjaer didn't make the substitution early enough with Martial. He should have done it way before the penalty. In fact, I would have brought him on at half-time, to be fair. But you know what? Let's not talk about United too much. And I know Rod isn't here yet, but I'm going to ask you guys this question. Oh, Rod is here. How are you doing, Rod?
Yeah, I'm okay. You?
Yeah, all good, mate. All good. Can't complain. Thanks for joining us. You good?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, look, we're talking about the United-Arsenal game, and apparently, according to many experts on social media, obviously, because Twitter is the Bible these days, apparently the wheels have fallen off whichever vehicle Ollie is driving. I mean, look, this is obviously a knee-jerk reaction from people who don't actually remember what a long run of games means with a depleted squad and what it does. Now, it's not the end of the world, is it?
No, he's just been on a massive run. And it's his first league defeat, and it's away against Arsenal, and you know, arguably could have come away with a win if Lukaku's chances went in. But yeah, it's nothing to worry about. People think of the United back as a threat now, so people start talking nonsense again. But no, I don't. No, it's just it was. You know, but at the end of the day, look at the two goals. It was a penalty, which was arguably not a penalty, and it was a mistake. Simple mistake that a world number one keeper hasn't done for a long time. So, you know, I would listen to Gary Neville when I was watching the game saying, you know, is he thinking about his contracts? It's just absolute nonsense. The guy's made a mistake. He's made a mistake. He's not a robot. Just simple, get on with it. He starts going on about, oh, he may be thinking about this in his mind. No, the guy's just made a mistake, and you know, he doesn't make many. You know, you think that his teammates might have pulled him out of it, the amount of times that he's pulled him out of it, but he just wasn't to be. And you know, it just wasn't our day, and deservedly Arsenal went on to win it. Really,
Dan, you're a Spurs fan, and I'm sure you've got some opinions in this game. I'm interested to know you know, your feeling on this one, because credit where it's due, Arsenal deserved the win. Aside from scoring, what do you think Arsenal did better than United?
I think, so this is just for me, and it's the same with last week's game against Tottenham as well. What I don't think Emery's a stupid guy. I actually think he's quite a good coach, and maybe Arsenal fans do now they've won a couple of games, because a couple of weeks ago they weren't so sure. But what Emery's worked out very quickly is Arsenal's defenders aren't very good. Okay, they are terrible defensively, and what he's done to counter that, like you touched on in your previous points, is he has dropped them deeper and deeper and deeper, because he's realised actually the only way they can stay solid as a unit is with a clear siege mentality remit, where they're going to sit back, have very little space in behind, defend as a team of five, as opposed to like the individuals they've been defending like for the last 2 to 3 seasons, mm-hmm. and then to start looking to pick people on the break. And they actually have got players in their squad that can hurt on the break. They've got two quick forwards. There's not many teams, you know, in the top 10 who can say that. Perhaps only Liverpool or Man City, in terms of having two out-and-out strikers who are pacey and can score. They've got players who can thread balls on the break. They've got a couple of engines in midfield. So the players they've got currently available to them is set up properly to hurt sides on the break. If you put Socrates deep, he's a solid... He reminds me of an average sort of mid-table centre-half who would play for like West Brom and Stoke in the old days, who literally is going to clear absolutely everything. If you're playing him in a high line, as he was earlier in the season with half-fit Koscielny next to him, Mustafi, who's a terrible player, you've got these defending just inside their own half, they're going to get absolutely exploited. And Emery's worked that out, and I think that's been the difference in the last two games against big opponents, even against Chelsea a month or so back. That's been the difference for Arsenal in the second half of this season, where he's actually realised what the limitations of his squad are, and he's now playing within the strengths of the players he's got. And in the summer, he'll replace him. He'll have five or six different players there at the beginning of the next season. So I've not touched on United much here. I thought they played okay, United, to be honest, away from home against Arsenal. People underestimate home advantage in these games between the top six. It's absolutely massive. You throw in the first goal on top of that as well. You know, unfortunate from a United perspective. And suddenly, it's a really tough remit to come back from that away from home. I thought United did okay. But from Arsenal, that they're winning now. They're winning now ugly. You know, they're sitting back and they're protecting their goalkeeper on the edge of the penalty box, and they're not leaving space for the opposition to exploit them. And they look a solid unit as a result.
Absolutely. And Rod, Leno kept Arsenal in the derby the other week with a double save and made sure Lukaku's run of form came to an end. Do you think he's done enough to prove he's their number one for the long term?
Retiring at the end of the season, and you know, with his display yesterday and with his previous displays, I think so. You know, there's not many keepers out there that you can choose from, and you know, he proved yesterday that he can win the game for him like he did, because you know, a couple of the saves were top class saves. Well, the second one definitely, because you know, if he didn't get his shin to it, it's certain, and that goes in it, and it could change the game, and they can lose. So yeah, he's winning them games now, so why not? He's good at his feet. He doesn't make many mistakes, and yeah, he's not a world class keeper, but you know, he's still young and he's a top class keeper. And there's not many world class keepers about, so yeah, I'd keep him. And you know, obviously they're going to have to get someone else in for number two, but I'm sure he's done to be number one. I'm sure they haven't got much money out of either. So betting they can't bring a top class keeper, so yeah, I think he's done enough to be their number one anyway.
Okay, Dan, I'm interested to know your take on the importance of Aaron Ramsey, mate. I mean, I've always rated him and believe Arsenal may struggle a little bit at the beginning of the season unless they bring in another quality midfielder. What do you reckon?
Well, I mean, I never used to rate him, although to be fair, I was a bit harsh on him because of the injury he had, and I probably didn't give him enough slack. But after, was it 2014, when he had that ridiculous half season where he was scoring every game, bagged the winning FA Cup final, he's improved a lot as a footballer and he started to fulfill his potential. Look, he's going to be hard to replace. I mean, they've lost him for free. It's a terrible situation for the football club, especially when he's playing well. And I think a measure of Ramsey and where he is now is the performance he's putting in after he's moved as well. You know, he's not like Rod mentioned that ridiculous point Gary Neville made about the hair maybe having his head elsewhere. I'm sure his head isn't elsewhere 12 minutes into a football match. It's absolutely ridiculous. Aaron Ramsey has signed for another football club and his head's not elsewhere. You know, he's there and he's still playing and giving back to the fans. And do you know what? It's nice to see from a footballer actually, like, putting in that level of effort week in, week out, irrespective of circumstances. I think they are going to miss him. And 6 or 7 years ago, I don't think I could ever see myself saying that about him. Because actually, you look at a lot of the top clubs and what they're missing. Where do you find these genuine, like, almost box-to-box midfielders now that are of any quality? They're so hard to find. So again, Arsenal are going to have to adjust slightly, adjust their system slightly again to accommodate him.
Okay. Well, speaking about central midfielders, Jan, a lot of credit has to go to the goal scorers. Xhaka has been heavily criticised by a lot of Arsenal fans for his performances, and Aubameyang's confidence has been questioned. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I thought Xhaka was pretty good yesterday. I thought he was, this is probably not the word you use, you know, about Xhaka a lot, but he was disciplined yesterday, wasn't he? You know, he sat in front of the back three, he controlled the midfield, he was up and down the pitch, he scored a really good goal, and that was one of his best games I've seen him play for Arsenal. As for Aubameyang, I'll be honest, I didn't see him do much in the pitch apart from score the goal, to be honest. I mean, Arsenal fans could disagree with me, but I don't know, he looked pretty anonymous, to be fair. You've got to give him credit, I guess. He missed an important penalty against Tottenham in the last minute to win it. So to step up, I guess, took guts, but they're already 1-0 up. It wasn't like it was 0-0 and he had to score. He was, you know, they're still winning 1-0, so that, you know, it wasn't as much pressure, but, you know, he took the penalty well, so.
To be fair, to roll it down the middle takes some guts. You don't want to miss a last minute penalty in the North London derby and then pass one straight to the keeper's foot because he hasn't moved. So I'll give him a little bit of credit for that, I guess. I mean, you could argue he didn't have to take it that way, so I wouldn't have had any sympathy for him, but, you know, to have the balls to roll it down the middle is probably a little bit different than just taking it, I guess.
I think he's done it because he's seen De Gea move. De Gea's gone to his left and he's just rolled it easy into the other corner, I think. So
yeah, maybe. De Gea looked quite annoyed after it. De Gea didn't look very happy.
Well, he doesn't save many penalties, to be honest.
Yeah, he's not a good penalty saver, is he, De Gea?
I think I can only remember two. There was Van Persie and there was Leighton Baines.
Leighton Baines, yeah.
That's the only two I can really remember. But anyway. Right, Arsenal's win made the race for third and fourth more interesting as Spurs suffered their third defeat in 5 games, losing 2-1 at Southampton. Dan, Spurs hit the woodwork twice before Kane gave Yorlott the lead. Pochettino said his players didn't take the second half seriously and called them arrogant. Now, judging by your WhatsApp message on Saturday, you echoed the manager's claims. Am I right?
Yeah, you're 3/4 right, to be honest. Actually, you wrote a tweet the other day about Pock turning into sound bites. Actually, I agree with most of what he says, most of his assessments. He normally says what I'm thinking. This is where I disagree with him. I think we were arrogant. I don't think we were arrogant in the second half. I think we were arrogant in the first half. And what I mean by that is, I message my mates, as we all do during games nowadays, to give my point of view. And this is where Tottenham are arrogant, and we have been for quite a while. We play games and we dominate football matches and we control possession and territory. And when we are swarming all over teams, only Man City do it better than us, in my opinion. It doesn't last 90 minutes. That's our problem and pretty much everyone's problem apart from Manchester City or Liverpool when they're having a good day at home, right? Why we're arrogant in the second half is because we play football matches like the other team are never going to get back into it. When there's only 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes gone. And this is the difference. This is where we struggle. We don't kill teams. We don't have that ruthless edge where if Manchester City have that first half that we had, they're coming in 3-0 up and that's it. It's game over. The other team don't even want to come out for the second half because they're so embarrassed. Never mind trying to get back into it. And that's where we're arrogant. In the second half, the other team are playing well. and we're struggling to get back into the game. I don't think that's arrogance. That's losing your foothold in the game, losing momentum and struggling to get it back. The arrogance is we're 1-0 up, we're playing so well, and we're almost playing in such a way that we think, well, we're 1-0 up, we're so good, we're playing so much better. There's no way this other team will get back into it. We'll just keep doing this and score when we feel like it. Eventually it stops. Eventually the dominance ends. The other team get a corner, a free kick, something happens, there's a break in play, and suddenly a little bit of momentum turns. This has happened a few times this season. It happened at home to Wolves, where we were pretty good in the first half. You know, that's a prime example. But it's happened to a degree in the game against Arsenal last week, where we went 1-0 down on the break. But in the first half, we were so dominant, but not ruthless. It's almost like we're choosing not to create chances of our dominance, because we think we're bossing this game, the spaces will open up. Actually, you've got to force it. You need to try and force these chances, because eventually the other team are going to come back into the game. And in the second half, we were a lot worse against Arsenal. It's the same thing. But that first half performance against Southampton, I can't fault it, apart from the fact that we don't continue to go for the jugular. We keep knocking the ball around and hoping that actually everything's going to stay the same. And it doesn't work like that. So we were arrogant in the first half. The second half, we just lost. I don't think there's anything more to it than that.
Plain and simple, easy. Rod, that's a massive win for Southampton, mate. I know we've been saying for a few weeks that their results haven't really mirrored their performances, but the high press they've adopted has really caused their opponents problems. Now, I don't know if you agree with me, but I can actually see them challenging for a European spot next season if they stay up. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that manager seems to have a style, a philosophy. When once you it gets going, and all the players get on board and know what he's trying to do, then it clicks. They've got some decent players, Sean. So yeah, I think they've got the right manager now. I think the players are slowly but surely getting to grips with what the manager wants, and you've seen the benefits of that on the second half of Tottenham, because you know they absolutely outplayed Tottenham. Tottenham didn't do any favours by the way they played in the second half, because you know they should have finished them off in the first half. But yeah, Southampton can go to strength to strength now. I think you know if they get a real like goal scorer that you can score them like that 15-20 goals a season, then yeah, I think they will be challenged for Europe. Yeah,
I'll tell you what, that Ward-Prowse is a player, isn't he? I see his free kick the other day in the one against United. I'm thinking, what's your problem? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, that's just the player that practices his craft every day, and now he's seeing the rewards on match days, because you know it's no fluke. He's putting him in the top corner from all angles. So you know, practice makes perfect, and he obviously spends a lot of time on the training field, and he's reaping the rewards now.
Absolutely. And another side who I think will be in with a shout of European qualification next season, if they retain their manager and give him transfer funds, is Newcastle, whose 3-2 win over Everton moves them up to 13th, 3 points behind the Toffees. Now, Jan, as the lads from the D&D Footy Factory said on a recent show, Rafa Benitez is the best manager outside the top six. Now, if Mike Ashley is smart, which I believe he is, he'll back Rafa as much as he possibly can next season, because there's huge potential at the club, is there not?
Yeah, well, I don't know about potential. I mean, Newcastle have always been that club where it's always nice to play up north, because they've got 30,000-40,000, you know, passionate Geordies, and it's just a nice place to play your football. I don't think they've showed enough ambition over the years to, you know, to challenge. Even when they were challenging United for the title, they could have won it, and then they've never progressed. Well, something needs to happen at Newcastle, because there's, you know, with Ashley not pumping any money in, you know, for Benitez to do what he's done at that football club with limited resources, he deserves like an MBE or something. I mean, you know, look at like the big clubs, even Everton, you know, the money that they spent, and look at what you know, Benitez signs. He signs Rondon on loan from West Brom, and he gets the best out of him, and he gets him scoring goals, and he gets the team playing around him. And you know, we've always said Benitez is a good manager, and the reason why Newcastle are doing so well, or why, you know, they won't go down, is because of Benitez. There's, you know, that's just a fact, as he says.
The reason Newcastle are doing so well is because Mr. Ferguson is not there.
But you know, if Ashley decides to sell the club and they get an investor who pumps money in and he stays at Newcastle, then you don't know what can happen over there. Mm. Then yeah, they could challenge for Europe next season. Why not?
Yeah.
Can you just say Mr. Ferguson again?
Mr. Ferguson.
I think I've just worked out who Jens Barber is.
We got it. Excellent. Rod, I know Newcastle rode their luck, mate. Pickford went full tub-thumping mode again, and a goal that should have been given as offside help, but 3 wins in 5 is nothing to be scoffed at. Arsenal are their next opponents, and I'm sure it won't be walking apart for Unai Emery's men.
No, it won't, and that's the kind of banana skin that the old Arsenal would slip a result on the weekend, so we'll have to wait and see, because you know, like you say, the 3 out of 5 is nothing to be scoffed at. So it's a great result, and especially when we're 2-0 down to a all right, they're struggling, but it's still a strong Everton side. So yeah, like the lad said, Rafa Benitez is a world class manager, and you know, he gets them organised, and now he's adding some quality to that. So and they're reaping the rewards of his great coaching and managing, because he is a world class manager.
Mm. Dan, when I look at the table, as I said, Newcastle only 3 points behind Everton, right? How much pressure do you think Marcus Silva is under now? Because I know he's coming out with excuses at the end of the game, saying, you know, decisions didn't go his team's way, yada, yada, yada. But their league form hasn't been great. He spent quite a bit of money in the summer, especially spending how much on Richarlison? Was it £50 million? He'll be, he's their fourth manager in the past 3 seasons. Do you think he'll be there next season?
No, I don't. Or it won't be long into the season if he does start the season. I think I look at Everton's lineup; it doesn't look that great on paper for all the money they've spent. You know, they've got like 100 million of attacking midfielders there, in Richarlison and Sigurdsson, as you say. And I look around it; there's not an awful lot there. I mean, it's great that they're giving like a homegrown young striker an opportunity in the first team. That's all well and good, but even the likes of Theo Walcott, that you know, Everton. Anything less than 8th for Everton has got to be considered a failure, hasn't it? You know, there's the 6 teams that obviously are a league above at the minute. So in terms of Silva, his assignment is pretty tough, because he can only ever achieve par, really. It's unrealistic he's going to finish 6th. And I think the pressure on him as well is actually, since the day he turned up here, I kind of hold him in high regard. Like, this guy looks like a good manager. He looks like he plays good football. But you look at the results he's getting, and more importantly, you look at some of the heavy defeats he's having across different clubs, and actually this is now his third team in the Premier League, and that's long enough to have worked it out, and he's not pulled up any trees. So I think the pressure on him, on himself, is going to mount up even more so because of that. And if you think I think he's the only manager in Premier League history to concede 6 goals at home with 3 different clubs.
Yeah.
And he's done that in the space of 18 months.
Yep.
So you've got to look fundamentally. I know, right, they were against Man City and Tottenham twice. But fundamentally, as a football manager, that identifies to me someone who like doesn't quite get the balance right between the style he wants to play and being able to defend. I know any team can get turned over once, but you know, it's not a coincidence that in 3 seasons he shipped 6 with 3 different clubs. So there's fundamentally something missing there. And the Everton fans, you know, they're not the most impatient bunch in the world, I don't think, but they still have an expectation of where Everton are a football club, and that expectation's fair. When you look at the teams they're mixing it up around, the likes of Bournemouth and Wolves, you know, Everton should be bigger than that. They've got a new owner in who's got some money, so things have improved financially. And at the end of the day, if you're spending £50 million on Richarlison, he needs to have a better return than he's got, or you need to spend £50 million on a player and build a team around him. Even in this day and age, £50 million is still a lot of money for Everton. They should be buying a player they can build a team around, and not, you know, I look at it and think, is that £50 million well spent on Richarlison? When it was spent, I kind of raised my eyebrows, and most people did, and said that's a lot of money. And then you get the people who say, well, that's how much players cost. But if you look at it, you know, could that money not have been spent on someone like Dusan Tadic, who's pulling up trees at Ajax? You know, I think it's a really poor purchase. I know he started pretty well; he's got 7 or 8 goals. But is his all-round performance enough to get a team like Everton where they need to be? I don't think so. You know, it always worries me when a manager goes back to their former club for players, and those players don't pull up trees, because I think, well, what else have you got to offer? Are you just going back to someone who you worked well with in the past and you think he's going to slot in? The game doesn't work like that. So that's a bit of a character assassination of a manager I like, but I don't think he'll be there next Christmas, to be honest. I don't think he's got what it takes to manage in this league anymore.
The only thing is, Dan, I know what you said about the Everton fans and how, you know, they're not an impatient lot, and I agree with you. I don't think that they expect too much either. I think that they know their level, if that makes sense. But give them something to cheer about. Give them something to look forward to. Maybe a cup run. I mean, that performance against Millwall was absolutely diabolical. I know it's an FA Cup game and these things happen, but if you know that you're not going to be in and around the top four, if you know that it's going to be a struggle to get a Europa League space via the league, go for a cup. Why not? They haven't won the FA Cup since 95. I mean, how long ago was that? 20 years ago? 24 years ago? Something like that? I mean, that's a long time to be waiting for a trophy for a club that size.
It is. And obviously, it's hard to win trophies for clubs like Everton at the moment. We know, but, you know, I agree with you. There's no reason for them not to prioritise this, because the reality is they're not going to finish any higher than seventh anyway. So unless they finish seventh, they're not getting the space. They're not going to get relegated. So why not put all your eggs into that basket? I agree. I guess the disappointing thing for Everton fans will be when they've had good sides, which they did have some good sides under Moyes. They had a decent midfield. They had, you know, a pretty good team. They weren't a well-beaten team, but it was a pretty good team. They got to an FA Cup final as well, didn't they? But you always had tough games at Goodison Park, whereas now there's all sorts of teams going to Goodison Park and picking up points with relative ease. You know, I know Wolves have had a good season. They're picking up results places, but they turned them over big time over there.
Yeah.
Spurs went there and scored six, and it could have been 11 or 12. And you just look, as a home fan, the least you want, if you're a proper football supporter, is when you go to your home ground, you see something that you enjoy and go home and say, you know what, that wasn't a wasted trip. Mm. And I think there's been too many wasted days out for Everton fans, and they aren't an impatient bunch, but I can understand why they're going to get frustrated if they're seeing that sort of performance at home. You just talked about Newcastle. Newcastle have been moaning for three or four seasons, and rightly so. But suddenly they've won five games in a row at home. And when they look at the end of the season and they throw their season ticket in the bin, they'll look at it and say, do you know what? We saw some good football matches there. We got some good results. Everton haven't got that at the minute.
There you go. Right, Burnley's 4-2 loss at Anfield, coupled with wins for Cardiff, Southampton and Brighton, put Sean Dyche's men back in the relegation dogfight. Rod, that is a big win for Cardiff, and their clean sheet means they've got more than United and Arsenal. Unbelievable. Neil Warnock spoke about the spirit within the camp. Now, this is a vital component to possess if they're to stay up, isn't it?
It's a massive component to have if you're coming up and you want to stay up, and, you know, most of the odds have had that, so it's no surprise that Cardiff have got it. So, but you know, they definitely need that, and it's a massive, absolute massive win. And you know, especially when Southampton turned it round, it made it an even extra massive win, because that keeps them in touching distance. Otherwise, you know, it would have been what, 5 points, 4 points, and it would have been almost curtains, because then, you know, you're expecting to win two team above you. So yeah, it was a massive win. It keeps the teams above them in close distance, and you know, with Arsenal and United, you wouldn't expect to get any points from that, but you know, but they'll get a point with Arsenal, and you know, with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer going back there, you never know. So you know how football works. So but yeah, it was a massive win, and hopefully, fingers crossed, they can get two or three more, and hopefully they get safe.
Mm. And Dan, we spoke about Brighton last week and how they're looking over their shoulder. They bounced back with an impressive win at Selhurst Park, although the man who scored the winner shouldn't have been on the pitch, should he?
No, he shouldn't have.
VAR.
He made the most of it, didn't he, to be fair? Because that was some goal. That was a great strike. But no, he shouldn't have been on the pitch. And it weren't a result I saw coming, to be honest. I thought Crystal Palace have been in relatively good form. They're quite solid at home. That's two wins in a row since we said Brighton should be a bit worried. So they're 6 big points now. I think, you know, there's a lot Cardiff would have to do, some tough fixtures to overcome that. So I don't know who's left down there now. Is it Burnley who are now a little bit precarious?
They're teetering on the edge.
Are you boys all like me, where you just want one team to drop like a stone and get sucked into it, just for the scenes?
Yeah.
I don't know who that's going to be now. It's only Burnley left, really, probably.
Yeah, I had it with Middlesbrough. It was a thing for me to get Middlesbrough relegated, and when they went down, it was bliss. Then they came back up and went back down again. But anyway, sorry, Borough fans. Jan, Liverpool didn't take long to break down Burnley when they went a goal behind. They passed this test with flying colours, giving Setes controversial win on Saturday.
Yeah, they did. And it shows, you know, that they're still fighting for this title, and, you know, and rightly so. I mean, you know, after Burnley going 1-0 up, it could have been nervy, but the fact that they got back into the game so quickly after the goal made it a little bit easier for them. Burnley did put up a fight, but Liverpool were comfortable and could have scored more goals. So it's going to be interesting to the end of the season. I think City will still drop points, and if Liverpool can capitalise on City's mistakes, then anything can happen.
Mm. And I think Liverpool are going to win the league title because Drake was spotted having a photograph with Sergio Aguero. We know Drake's history with clubs. I think he's jinxed 6 separate teams in the US. So, yeah, I think it was planted there by Liverpool. But anyway, I don't think Guardiola would be using that excuse, really. So, in other news, in the infinite wisdom at the powers that be of fourth place West Brom, they decided to sack Darren Moore. Rod, West Brom's chief exec, Mark Jenkins, said, "But we had to place the club's best interests at the forefront of our thinking, and we must do everything we can to deliver the promotion we have targeted." I guess this is what bullshit smells like.
Yeah, I've had a lot to say about this, but it's just one of them ones where, you know, it's just bizarre. You know, he's fourth in the league, and you don't know if there's someone else comes in at what reaction. They're expecting a good reaction. It could go the other way. You know, mostly that it goes the other way and people get a reaction. But, you know, they're usually with a team that's absolutely struggling and at the bottom of the league. To be fourth in the league and have a chance of still being promoted, and the results that what he did last year and getting the club back together and sorting the squad out and the team out to start the championship was a very difficult league. And he's fourth. Yes, he's had a bad run, but you'd expect your employees to back you, and they haven't. And it's just, I hope they just get relegated and they go into liquidation.
I know a lot of people have been very vocal about Darren Moore sacking, and there's been, I wouldn't say an accusation, that it's because of the colour of his skin. Is that fair to say? Has he been judged because of his colour of his skin, or is it just a poor form where that the board have basically panicked and felt, well, one win in, was it 6 home games or something like that?
I think they're just going on his form, but still, you know, he's, look at his form throughout the season. He's fourth in the league. It's going to be the usual suspects in it. You know, Paul Lintz, I can name him on one hand. You could say that, but you know, I would like to think that it wasn't that, but it could possibly be that it was colour of his skin. But you know, I just think it's not a big massive aim to treat him like that, and especially being a club legend. It's just totally disrespectful, and like I say, it's just a lack of respect, lack of class, and I hope they get relegated and liquidated.
Fair enough. Now, as a young, promising manager loses his job, an experienced one who failed miserably in his last role, mind, has wormed his way back into another job 8 days after being sacked from his last one. Step up Claudio Ranieri. He's coming to replace Eusebio Di Francesco until the end of the season and hopes to move Roma back into the top four. I know they won today 2-1 against Empoli thanks to a VAR decision, but Dan, please help me, man. How does he keep doing this?
Well, he doesn't get sacked for colour of his skin, that's for sure. So that does annoy me, actually, that there's no way Darren Moore's been sacked for colour of his skin, I would say. And the thing with a lot of West Brom fans are criticising the type of football he plays, and they forget when West Brom were in the Premier League for 10 years, they served up nothing but dross, and now suddenly it's a problem. Ranieri, yeah, he must have the best agent in the world. I guess his relationship with Roma and the Roma fans is strong. He managed them before. He finished second to Inter Milan when they won the treble in 2010, when they won the Champions League. Mourinho, isn't there? I guess for him,
Inter?
Mourinho.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. So it's an easy appointment for Roma because he's available and he's managed the club before, and they'll bring him in. I mean, I don't expect him to stay at the club. I don't think it's going to be a Solskjaer-style appointment where he magically turns everything around and there's a big clamour to appoint him. I think there was a lot of problems at the club with Monchi and Di Francesco. The sacking was on the cards. They couldn't wait to the end of the season. They got rid of him. And there's the perfect man sitting there waiting to pick up the reins. But you can't not like Ranieri, can you? It's almost like every time he gets a job, it's just a big, massive smile because it's funny and he just pops up all over the place. But, you know, it was only 3 years ago he was winning the Premier League title. Whether it was, you know, fortunate, freaky, whatever, he still did it. So just for that reason alone, you know, I can't help but give the man a little bit of respect.
But he's there to the end of the season, right? So, look, if he gets top four, I don't know if he's going to keep the job or not. I personally think that Sarri's going to get the Roma job in the summer. That's what I believe. I don't know about you guys. Jan, I know you're a Serie A connoisseur.
You know, Ranieri's had about 18 different clubs in his whole managerial career.
Yeah, so Sarri.
Yeah. But Ranieri's won the league.
Yeah, true. He won something. Yeah.
I think if he gets Roma playing a certain style of football and gets him in the Champions League, I think they'll give him like a 1 or 2 year contract and see what happens. That's what I think.
Well, Totti's his right-hand man, isn't he?
Yeah, and you know, we know Totti's Mr. Roma, so, you know, it's a bit like United, really, with Solskjaer and kind of Fergie in the background, isn't it?
Mm.
It's a bit like the same where, you know, Ranieri is like that at Roma, Totti's there, and, you know, if they can form a good duo, then why not? I mean, Roma seem to attract decent players, but they never seem to do anything with them.
Well, they got rid of Monchi, haven't they? He's gone.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is a bad thing, to be honest, because the guy's an utter fraud, but anyway.
I don't know. I just think with a little bit more investment, Roma can actually be a force, but then again...
But you could say that for most Serie A teams. You could say it for most of them.
Yeah, you can do, but the gulf between Juventus and everybody else is massive. You know, so Juventus need to have a big decline and the others need to improve massively. But, you know, with Ranieri at the helm now, then, you know, he can attract players because of his track record in the past. And you never know what can happen there.
Absolutely. But the thing is, when you look at the Serie A table, I think, Juventus are flying high at the moment. They've won the league already, haven't they? There's no
Celtic
stopping.
Have won it.
Sorry?
Celtic
have won it, yeah. Well, look at Napoli. They're on 57 points with, 11 games to go. So you're looking at a possible, 33 points. Now, effectively, okay, I'm not saying they're going to win every single game, but if they were to, they'll come second with 90 points. Can you imagine?
Yeah, well, anything's still possible, but we're still talking about Roma, right?
Yeah, it's about Roma now.
They're not going to pick up 33 points. So
No. I'm talking about Napoli. You know, if Napoli get 33 points from their remaining 11 games, they'll be on 90 points. But I'm just saying. You're saying that, you know, the gulf is massive. But what I'm saying is Napoli is incredible how they could end up runners up on 90 points.
Yeah.
Hypothetically speaking.
Well, it's a little bit like United last season, isn't it? With Man City on another year, United potentially wins the league, but, you know, City stormed it last year. But it's the same every year, and, you know, until somebody proper challenges Juve consistently, I don't see the Italian league changing. I see Juventus dominating still for years and years to come.
Yeah. Well, the top four, the place for the last two Champions League spots or the race, should I say, is actually hotting up, because you've got Milan on 51, Inter on 50, Roma on 47, Torino and Atalanta on 44. So that could be one to look out for. But anyway, let's move on, and we'll move swiftly on to another club that begins with R and has major issues. Real Madrid have today sacked Santiago Solari and replaced him with not Big Sam, Alan Pardew or Mark Hughes, but Zinedine Zidane. Gents, this broke a couple of hours ago. I don't know if you guys have had much time to really think about it. Rod, Zidane back at the helm at Real Madrid. Now, this is a big test for him, because a certain Cristiano Ronaldo isn't there, and he was the guy that kind of dragged them over the line every game. But then again, Gareth Bale is still there, and we know how his relationship with Zidane was.
Yeah, well, pretty much guaranteed now that Gareth Bale is going to leave, because, you know, I don't see the relationship changing. And you know, the way he treated Gareth Bale, he spent a lot of time on the bench. I don't think that the relationship was great, so I can see him leaving, you know. Zidane's not daft. The way that they're playing and losing Cristiano Ronaldo, he must have had some assurances that the players that they're going to bring in. So, you know, with getting rid of Gareth Bale, you know, it's pretty much guaranteed that Hazard's going to go, or i.e. that then leaves Chelsea in a predicament with their transfer embargo. So, you know, it's going to be exciting. But, you know, definitely had assurances that Real Madrid would be bringing players in, that's for sure. He wouldn't be going there. But the Gareth Bale situation is a real situation, and you know, because it was very frosty when he left. So just before he left, and they just won the Champions League. So yeah, it's a good thing for Real Madrid, or is it? We'll see how good Zidane is now, because you know Ronaldo though did pull Real Madrid through the last couple of seasons anyway, with the goals he scored, with the time that he spent there. But it's a massive loss to lose someone like that. But they're going to have to bring some top class players in, because, and I'm sure he's had assurances, like I said. But yeah, it's exciting, because this year's been tough. He's been drab for a minute.
It's a bit of a weird one, Dan, because I know when Zidane released a press release when he resigned, he said, "There are complicated moments in the season when you ask, am I still the right person? I don't forget the hard moments too." It's been a hard season for Real Madrid this season. They're way behind Barcelona. We saw in El Clasico, in fact, both of them recently, that they're miles behind on the pitch as well. What's happened here? Has his arm been twisted? Has he been thrown an extra zero in the end of his contract? I don't know.
I think it's really weird. I guess when he left, I was surprised, but I guess everyone assumed it was an issue with certain players or contracts or whatever. But coming back is strange. This happened a month ago at Monaco, where they brought back Jardim, when they only sacked him a few months before, 6 months before. Next thing you know, he's back at the club. At Real Madrid, it's stranger, because what we hear about Real Madrid is they can have literally whoever they want. They can just turn up and pick any managers, and therefore going back to someone so soon, admitting that they got something wrong publicly on that scale seems a little bit odd. They've obviously promised him a load of money, but most managers get a load of money at Real Madrid anyway. The bit about Gareth Bale, obviously, it's the first thing I thought when it happened, is Gareth's going to be looking at and kicking, and his agent's going to be rubbing his hands together. But there's two bits to this. Gareth Bale doesn't strike me as a sort of player who's going to sit on the bench and collect salary. If you heard his interview after the Champions League final, he said, he clearly said he just got two goals and won the game, one of the best Champions League final goals I've ever seen. And he sits there and says, well, I'm going to stick with my agent. Something's got to change. I've not played as much football as I'd like. So I can't see Gareth Bale sitting there. But then, you know, things can change between players and managers. I wouldn't go and put my life savings on him leaving. Do you think when Jose Mourinho took the Manchester United job and everyone's first reaction was, oh, Wan-Mata, he bombed him out of Chelsea, what's going to happen? You know, Wan-Mata's still there, and he's had a pretty prosperous three or four seasons, didn't he? So I don't think it's game over. He carries a massive salary. He's not going to want to take a pay cut. There's probably only two or three clubs that would be able to afford the package it's going to take to Gareth Bale there. So I don't think it's by any means a certainty whatsoever that Gareth Bale is going to be on his way out in the summer. I know Man United will be heavily linked, and let's be fair, the media have been trying to get Gareth Bale at Man United since he was 15. So I expect the same stories to be rolled out, but I think there's a little bit to run in that one.
Mm. Yeah, and are you going to see Mark Morrison come out and release Return of Zidane?
Yeah. My first instinct today still was Mourinho's going PSG.
It's going to happen, isn't it? Yeah, you know it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I think Tuchel at PSG's thinking, that's me done now.
Tuchel was broken, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Because, you know, it's like what Mourinho said before, didn't he? He said, I can have the league, wrapped up in a pocket, another league, but I chose to stay here. He's talking about PSG. Anybody who goes to PSG has won the league before the ball's even kicked. That's even worse than than Serie A and the Scottish League, to be fair. You know, the ambition of that club now, I mean, I know diverting away a little bit from Zidane, but the ambition of PSG is to win the Champions League. That, you know, that's their ambition now. So, you know, I can only see Mourinho going there that now that Zidane's got the job. As for Zidane going back to Real Madrid, apparently, from what I read today, you know, it's the players that wanted him back. Apparently, there was a big kind of meeting and they've asked the players who they want as their manager, and they said, we want Zidane back. So, you know, and as Rod said, Zidane would not have gone back there if he weren't assured in the summer that they're going to bring XYZ to the club. Because if you want to talk about a team in decline, you know, he's finally saying that after, you know, the club's won 3 Champions Leagues in a row. But Real Madrid is certainly a team in decline. And it just showed how valuable Ronaldo was. I don't think the Real Madrid fans have ever appreciated how Ronaldo, you know, how good Ronaldo was. You know, they were booing him, for goodness sake. So, you know, in a selfish kind of way, I'm glad what's happened to them this season as well.
Mm. I fully agree with what you lot said about having transfer funds in the summer. I know Eden Hazard is top of their wanted list, so to speak. They've got a big deal with Emirates at the moment to sponsor the stadium. They're going to be increasing the capacity. I think it's a big transitional phase for Real Madrid. We saw kind of back in the last season how Zidane didn't really spend big in players. He brought in a few youngsters through Castilla and a few others. But yeah, I don't know. It's going to be a very interesting summer for both Real Madrid and Man United, because if they both have cash injections, you just never know what's going to happen. But yeah.
Still, I could see Bale moving to United this summer. I could see United offloading Sanchez, who's on a massive wage bill at United.
Well, Valencia's out, isn't he?
Valencia's out. So I can see, you know, Sanchez is, what, 350, 400k a week, allegedly, at United. I could see him being sold to maybe, I don't know, China, somewhere.
He's the type of coach trainer as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And maybe that would, you know, free the funds to bring in Bale at United. So. Oh,
God, are you suggesting that he's going to get the number 7 shirt?
Yes.
Okay, that's all right. Just as long as he doesn't get the number 11, because I don't want Anthony Martial kicking off about that again. Crying out loud. Christ. Okay, gentlemen, on to Eurotrash.
And now it's time for Eurotrash.
Now, I've got 3 stories, and I want you guys to select the best of the worst. Yeah? You ready?
Yep.
Okay, so,
and now it's time Jürgen for Klopp. Eurotrash.
Well, we know he's provided us with many geologically related excuses as to why his teams have dropped points this season, so it's only right that we take a story from his homeland where Mother Nature celebrated International Women's Day by shafting Hanover out of a goal.
And now it's time for
when
Eurotrash.
When Genki Haraguchi rounded the Leverkusen goalkeeper and aimed at goal, he thought he'd pulled one back for his team. He was wrong. As the ball rolled towards the net, the snow on the pitch slowed it down and stopped it dead before the goal line. Hanover did pull a goal back in the second half, but Leverkusen ended up winning 3-2. Now, staying in Germany, an on-loan Arsenal midfielder, Reece Nelson, was left out of the Hoffenheim squad at the weekend for, and I quote, educational reasons. This prompted numerous news outlets to publish stories that this was down to disciplinary issues, despite having zero evidence, zero quotes, or anything else that would back up their claims. Lovely. Story 3 comes from Italy, where Atalanta head coach Gianpiero Gasperini pushed Sampdoria's general secretary Massimo Lenca in the tunnel after being sent off over protesting. Incidentally, Gasperini and Lenca fell out about 10 years ago after Lenca insulted Gasperini and his players. Lenca was fined and suspended by Torino and is now using the recent incident as a way to get back at Gasperini by taking him to court. Nothing too funny here, no razor blades, although Jan has shaved his head, Rod. I don't know if you've seen the photo. So yeah, gents, best of the worst. I think there's only one win in this one, but go on.
I think it's the Gasperini story.
Yeah? Any reason?
It just sounds childish and I like it.
Okay. Simple things. Please, simple mind. Dan?
Yeah, it's Gasperini. Anyone who holds a grudge for that long and goes to them lengths has got to win the vote, and it surely.
Did you see the push though?
I saw it on Twitter not long before coming on. It took me a little while to work out what it was all about, but yeah, just for the longevity of how long he's waited to do it, and you know, if you waited that long, you'd probably do something a bit better, wouldn't you?
Well, it was like handbags in an old people's home, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's probably imagined that moment every night for the last however many years, and he's going to feel disappointed when he gets home. So winning this particular vote might cheer him up a little bit.
Rod, is Mother Nature going to win this time, or is the Italians going to, take the crown?
Yeah, full house.
I was hoping you guys would go for the goal line one, but I don't know if you guys have seen it. No?
No, I haven't seen that one.
It was agonising, mate. The guy's gone round the goalkeeper. He's rolled in. As it's rolling, you heard of the snowball effect, but this is more like the football effect. It just rolled and it stopped literally before the goal line. It was remarkable. And I didn't think there was much snow actually there either, to be honest. But yeah, I'm sure you've seen it, no?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah. I mean, it happened in England once, did it? Was it in Holland?
I don't know.
He's gone to score a goal and there was like, I know it's not snow, I think it was mud. And he's rounded the keeper, he scored, and then he's gone to celebrate, you know.
He's off on a corner flag.
Yeah, and the ball didn't cross the line, so. I've seen it before, but the fact that with Gasperini, like, handbags and grudges and old men fighting or whatever it is, it's funny.
Things what I didn't understand about that, the first one in Germany, if you know that the ball is sticking to the pitch, because that was happening throughout the whole game, why don't you put
a bit of power in it, don't you?
Yeah, or just hit it high. Perhaps? I don't know. Anyway. Right, gentlemen, one more thing before we wrap up the show. We've had a question from DJ, and you guys can probably answer this one better than I can. He's asked, with the recent terrible incidents of fan encroachment onto the pitch over this weekend, do you think the call for safe standing areas will be shelved while the call for player safety gets louder with the possible return of bars, barriers or glass enclosures to prevent a worse situation like an armed individual trying to do bodily harm to a player during the game? Look forward to hearing your answer on the next show, mate. Cheers. So, I had this discussion on BBC Radio Asia earlier, and someone said maybe they should put net in. Do you think that this is going to damage safe standing or the calls for it, Rod?
If one idiot wants to get on, I don't think you're ever going to stop it. I think the only way you're going to stop it, and they've missed the trick here, by just giving the guy 14 weeks. You know, it's just pitiful, that. It's just 14 weeks. We'd be out in a month. Yeah. So it's not a deterrent. If you know, if he comes back and say the guy's got 2 years or 3 years, then people think, "Whoa, I'm not doing that." But you know, 14 weeks, he's still going to always get an idiot. If you know, especially with social media these days, you know, it didn't help when most of the fans are cheering when he's coming off. The guy's just ran on the pitch and punched a player. What the fuck are you cheering him for? You're stupid. Mm-hmm. So you know, And when he comes out, he'll be a bit of an hero with his mates. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's let his club down. He's let his family down. He's let himself down. The guy's a clown. To go on and punch someone from the back is a shithouse move anyway. And to do it to a footballer on the football field. He's with his dad. You know, the guy's a clown and shouldn't be banned for 10 years. Should be banned for life and be locked up for a lot more than 14 weeks.
So do you think that's going to hinder the possibility of safe standing? Because it's something that a lot of people have been rallying for a few years now.
So I don't think... So to answer DJ's question, I don't think safe standing is ever going to happen in this country, if I'm honest. And I don't like to say never, but there's been a clamour for this for quite a long time now. It's not really getting any louder. And actually, atmospheres in football stadiums have changed fundamentally that... Safe standing isn't really of that much benefit to anyone anymore. Like there's only a small percentage of fans in the ground who actually want to stand in this day and age. Is the honest truth. You know, you used to go like in the 80s and 90s to football matches, and actually there was people like like us, or like, you know, our age now, and people who are going berserk and running from one side of the pitch to the other. Whereas now you've got families, you've got, you know, older people, you've got women and children who want a seat and can't stand. So at best, it's only going to be one stand anyway. Then you think of what comes with that one stand. It's not an awful lot of additional people. And actually, there's no real clamour for it. People don't need the money. People don't need the money to do it. Most clubs are struggling to fill stadiums anyway. So having a load of empty seats at the other end because the people who want the stand have all crammed into the other side is just gonna, it's just going to make that bigger. And there's no real financial benefit from doing it. The money, most of the money clubs benefit from come from TV sponsorship, other areas anyway. And outside of like League One, the you know, League Two and below, of, well, certainly below, they stand anyway because the stadiums aren't developed. So I think it's something this country's dragged its heels about, and it's not something that there's really an appetite to do. You get nets up in like German grounds, don't you? The last German ground I went to was Bremen, and I was stuck behind a net. And you get netting in a lot of the Italian grounds as well. So you might see netting, but I do think that this will soon be brushed under the carpet as a one-off incident. The reason I'd probably want to see nets is more the amount of coin throwing and bottle throwing that goes on at football grounds, which for me is a lot more serious because it happens every single game. Whereas one idiot running onto the pitch has happened, like we've said earlier, and Rod touched on there. And you know, thankfully, that's a rare occurrence and probably won't happen. Hopefully, for a little while again. But the netting certainly is something that needs to be considered because we saw glass bottles in Scotland, for fuck's sake. I mean, we've gone from plastic bottles without lids to people throwing on like glass bottles of whiskey. So something needs to be done about that. That can be done. Netting that can be quickly, you know, dealt with. But safe standing, I just don't think it's going to happen, DJ.
Jan, safe standing, yay or nay?
No. I don't think it'll happen, and I think they'll bring the nets up in this country. I think if it carries on the way it has been, then I think the nets will come up sooner rather than later. Something has to happen because
you know, certain grounds, it's like, you know, if you're at West Ham, you're going to find it difficult to get on the pitch. If you're at Old Trafford, it might be difficult to get on the pitch because there's that kind of slope. But there's some grounds where it's really close, and you're not going to stop someone. Yes, and netting might stop it, but if you really want to get on that pitch, you know, someone's going to, you know, with a little standing knife, a little pocket knife, can like cut the net, and they're going to jump on. It's very, very difficult to stop it. If you get one idiot, the only way you're going to stop it is if someone really gets really, really hurt, and you know, it ends up some idiot ruins it for everyone. But you know, the netting, it'll probably come up like Jan says, but if some idiot wants to get on the pitch and he's set upon doing that, then it's going to be very, very difficult to stop him.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, gents, before we wrap it up, we don't have a game. Well, I didn't have a game planned until Jan jumped on. Jan, do you want to do that voice of your barber so we can guess which nationality he is?
Are you ready?
Sounds like a really bad porno, mate. Rod, do you want to guess the nationality of Jan's barber?
Albanian.
Nope.
Dan? Okay, Dan, you're not there? You gone?
It's got to be Cypriot or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, probably.
No. I'm sticking with Amir Zaki. He's Egyptian. It's an Egyptian barber.
Okay, Jan, can you give us a clue at least?
They participated in the current World Cup that's just gone.
Oh, for crying out loud, Jan.
Yeah, but is that a European club or?
Well, it's they're not European, no.
Okay, I'm going to guess. Is he Iranian?
Yeah, spot on.
Yes! Yes! Yes, I get to do the quiz next week.
Hold on, did I do a good Iranian accent?
I, do you know, I don't know that many Iranian people, and most of them have got Cockney accents. So,
well, my brother-in-law is Iranian, so I'll ask him.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Brilliant. There you go.
I got worried when he said that, and then when he cut my hair, I was actually quite relieved.
Comes out with a carving knife. Brilliant. Right, gents, that's it for our show. Thank you ever so much for your time. It's been great having you guys on, and it's been great talking about football. Before I let you guys go, Twitter handles, Jan?
Yannickus J.
Rod?
Rod James Giggs.
DDL.
Underscore DDL underscore 10.
Underscore 1-0. Underscore, we're done. That's it for us this week. You can follow us on Twitter @ShootDefence. Until next time, goodbye.